You're listening to Joel Rheinberger on 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
It's going to be a busy day in both the upper and lower houses of Tasmania's Parliament this morning. Joining me to discuss those matters is Tony McCall, political scientist from the University of Tasmania. Tony, good morning to you.
Good morning, Joel.
So, look, abortion reform, has this been a harder fight than you think maybe Michelle O'Byrne expected?
Well, I think it's inevitably a harder fight when you're connecting any piece of legislation to such a sensitive issue about abortion. I think her problem, of course, is that at the constituency level in Tasmania, not everyone understands what the intent of this bill is. And, of course, it doesn't matter how you try to define the decriminalisation of all abortions, in other words, within a sort of a legal requirement, the real focus of attention is on abortion itself. So it's very difficult to, I think, distinguish between what you're trying to do and the passions and ideas and values that people bring to this particular issue.
It's interesting. I think most people that I've seen tend to agree that it shouldn't be part of the criminal code, and then there's a big but at the end of that.
Well, I think that's the problem, because the Reproductive Health Bill, as it's called, is actually trying to decriminalise all abortions. They're not trying to, stop them. They're trying to provide a legal framework around them. But, of course, in many ways, trying to reduce a contentious, debated, complex issue to a legal framework is really a message that not everyone wants to hear. So I think the bulk of the opposition to the bill is being driven by the anti-abortion lobby rather than really concentrating on the technical component that the minister's trying to get passed through the parliament. And then on top of that, I think from the perspective of the members of particularly the House of Assembly in the first instance, 12 months out from an election, your ears very firmly cocked in the direction of your constituents. You're listening very closely to them, even if they're confused about what the legislation's about. And I think given the fact that there's no one, for example, in the Labor and the Liberal parties that's come out, both, of course, everyone getting a conscience vote, come out in vocal support of the bill, I think the prospects are pretty grim.
Now, conscience vote, how common is a conscience vote on any matter in the Tassie Parliament?
Well, it's quite rare. A lot of people, of course, a lot of people in electorate, citizens in Tasmania, some would prefer to see more conscience votes because they would like to see their members not so tied to the discipline of parties. But of course, that's a reality that doesn't occur for a whole range of reasons.
I've got to
make an efficient, governance framework. But I think it's when there's a recognition in the parliament that there are moral and ethical issues, particularly that go beyond party discipline, that the conscience votes are called for.
There's actually a text that came in a little bit earlier this morning saying, by the way, I know that this might be shocking to our pollies, they're supposed to be using their consciences every time instead of just towing the party line.
Well, we could have a long discussion about that, Joel, but I think we'll move on.
Do you think that people are still going to largely vote with where their party would vote, or do you think there's going to be a really big difference to the way these votes are split this time?
Well, that's my point. I think 12 months out from an election, yes, you are going to listen to your constituency. You'll have personal views on it, but I think at the end of the day, you'll be very, very cognizant of how you think, the majority of your constituents that support you as a political party are going to vote, and I think that will sway you in a very pragmatic way. It may very well upset some some members of parliament who feel quite strongly about this, but I think they're going to be cognizant of how it's going to place the party when election campaigns start, particularly in Tasmania, say at the beginning of next year. People are very they've got long memories about voting patterns around these particular issues, and some of these organised groups are well resourced. They can really damage the electoral aspirations of those who support or don't support their particular positions.
Now, if it gets through the lower house, what do you think is going to happen when it gets to the Legislative Council?
Well, again, I think it's a little early to make any judgment about it, but I suspect on past voting patterns it's likely to go the same way as some of the other social reform agendas have gone in recent times and probably be defeated. Again, for the same reasons. I mean, there's three Legislative Council elections, two existing members, a new candidate will be elected in the North West Coast to replace the retiring President Sue Smith. But, yeah, again, it's very close to elections, very conservative, pragmatic approaches that all, I think, existing members and those who are anticipating being elected, they're going to take the sort of pragmatic central perspective, I think, on most of these issues.
And now on to probably the only thing that could be more complicated than an abortion bill in Tasmania, which would have to be a forestry bill in Tasmania. Independent MLC Tony Mulder has put an amendment into the Tasmanian Forest Agreements to delay permanent protection of forest reserves. What do you think is going to happen? Do you think there's just going to be gridlock over this?
Well, I think there is gridlock. I think that was the problem. It's worth just a moment to reflect on what happened here, Joel. I think so. We had an agreement prior to a bill. Now we've probably got a bill that may. So for example, let's assume that this amendment is supported by the Legislative Council. That may mean that we'll have a bill passed through the Parliament that doesn't match up to the requirements of the original agreement. What then in turn happens if it's returned to the House of Assembly? Will the Greens, for example, support the amendment? I'm assuming that if the government the government leader in the Legislative Council indicates support for Mr. Mulder's bill, then the government in the House of Assembly, particularly the Premier's, had a very long conversation with Mr. McKim about what response the Greens will have in the Parliament. I suspect that they're not going to go to the embarrassment of supporting a Legislative Council amendment that will go back to the House of Assembly and then find that their minority government partners aren't prepared to support it. So, it's been a difficult process. In many ways, I think the process that was adopted really has got us to where we are. I'd also add that I think, quite frankly, Joel, whilst the Parliament's still grappling with this agreement, in the community there's less conversations about forestry than there were 6 months ago. People have I think, made very strong determinations in terms of their perspectives on where this is at. But again, we have to wait to see what happens. The other really interesting component of it is where will this bill, when it is passed or if it is passed, where will it stack up against the requirements for the funding agreements with the Commonwealth? To me, not all of that's clear. On the other hand, people in the Legislative Council, particularly with the the absence of members, you might find that the bill will be defeated or it'll be a draw, and then I think we can assume that the President, Sue Smith, will vote the legislation down.
Tony McCall, thank you for being on the program this morning.
Thank you, Joel.
Tony McCall there from the University of Tasmania.
Helen, what are you wearing?
My farming festival outfit, Damien.
It's Agfest. No need to look like you're auditioning for the village people.
Oh, so you want these chaps back then?
I don't want you to get mud on them. But is that really what you want to wear when you interview one of ABC's biggest names?
Oh, my giggling hoot interview on the Saturday, yeah.
Find Helen and Jimmy and I and all your ABC mates at Agfest with the Weather Bureau on site 82, right next to the Tasmania Fire Service.
More details online at abc.net.au/Hobart.
Now put the stock whip down.
You're listening to Statewide Mornings on 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania. My name is Joel Reinberger, just in the chair for today while Leon's away. If you've been watching the national news or listening to our news this morning, you would have heard that some explosions went off at the finish of the Boston Marathon overnight. Shane James from Somerset, Tasmanian runner, is there as we speak. Shane, how are you doing today?
Yeah, how you going, Joel? A bit shaken up, as you can imagine. It's not a real good way to attempt to finish a marathon. Yeah, it's surreal, to be honest with you.
Tell us what happened to you. I mean, you're in, what, kilometre 42. You're in the very last dregs of the marathon, absolutely exhausted. And what happened for you?
Yeah, I was actually having a really good finish to the race. Me and another guy who helped me out, Phil Madeira from the Genzyme team, running for rare diseases, and yeah, we're going along nicely, and then all of a sudden there was just a massive group of people in front of us. Stopped and just realised, you know, like asked what was going on, and they'd said that there'd been two explosions gone off, and then a short while after that, I actually heard another one go off, so yeah, it was pretty horrific, to be honest.
So you're saying three altogether?
Yeah, they've got to actually confirm the third one since I've heard radio reports over here, but I've definitely heard it's an explosion for sure. And they actually found other bombs as we were getting our bags and that from the buses organised about, oh, I don't know, it might could have been at least an hour and a half later, but they found more bombs, so we just basically got out of the city.
What was the crowd reaction? Was there panic or were people still fairly measured?
From reports that I've spoken to a couple of photographers, the crowd's reaction sort of took a couple of minutes to sort of really hit in, and then like everyone was sort of calm for a while, and then there was a bit of panic after that. But the runners itself weren't really in panic. I'd just call it more shock.
Now, how are you actually feeling now? How are you doing yourself?
Yeah, it's still a bit surreal. And in, to be honest, a little bit of shock myself. My body feels fine as far as running the 42K and the rest of it. But just, yeah, it's strange not finishing the marathon, and just obviously feel for the people that are deceased and injured and their families and all the rest of it. You know, you go to something so prestigious as the Boston Marathon and end up with something like this coming away from them. It's just words that are pretty hard to describe. You know, it's just terrible.
Shane, tell us, where are you off to next? Because I know that you run races all over the world.
I'm off to Las Vegas next weekend. I have a marathon called Labor of Love, and then I'm doing Grand Canyon Rim to Rim to Rim for a documentary that's putting together on myself called Run to Live. So that should be spectacular, but yeah, not in the best of spirits to sort of think about those things at the moment, Joel, but yeah, I've got some really good things happening.
Well, Shane, look, thank you so much for speaking with us. Do look after yourself, and best of luck in those future runs.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks again, Joel, and yeah, much appreciated.
Shane James there from Somerset, who's been running in the Boston Marathon today.
Nerdzilla returns after a long break with our longest ever episode. Our latest Rogue podcast includes the world's biggest original Battlestar Galactica fan. No newfangled CGI for this guy. We review the TV show Da Vinci's Demons, which portrays Leonardo as a superhero. And we debate what is the world's greatest internet meme while doing it Gangnam style with a grumpy cat. Nerdzilla the podcast, made by nerds for nerds and BO-free since 2012.
On 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania this morning, Jeff Kennett, chairman of Beyond Blue, is in town to launch the Child and Adolescent Bushfire Disaster Response for the people in Dunalley, as well as being here for a Beyond Blue board meeting. He came and visited the studio a little earlier this morning. I thought a Beyond Blue board meeting would be really interesting, so I asked him, what did they actually discuss?
We meet every 2 months. Our board members are made up of people from around Australia. From Tasmania, Fiona Coote is one of our board members. And we have a range of issues. We discuss new programs that we might be investing in, new research. We've just completed a redesign of our website, which we'll be launching shortly. We're about to launch a major campaign on anxiety throughout Australia, and that's taken us almost a year to develop. So we have a whole lot of other research programs. So we meet regularly. We have a very large workload, and of course, I try and move the board around the country so that we can meet those that we work with, whether it be in the public service or the private sector. And as you said today, because of the bushfires down south earlier in the year, we're launching this new initiative, which is based on experiences after the Queensland floods, with the same academics involved, to try and help particularly young children who are often traumatised by natural disasters, in this case fire. And this program has been refined and developed. We'll work with the community down around Dunalley. we will, through consistent care, try and identify particularly children who might appear to be handling the situation well, but are internally stressed and anxious. And if we can address their issues early, then these things might just wash through their system. Often if you don't address them, they end up...
Festering?
Festering is a good word, and could often cause serious damage later in life. So it's a wonderful program.
Now, what are the signs of trauma in children who have been through this sort of thing?
Often they withdraw. Often they become more aggressive. They resist authority. They have trouble relating to their parents, etc. They might have trouble relating to other children. So there's a number of signs that those who are trained in this particular area can identify quite easily. And the beauty of this program, is that they'll work not only with the children, but they'll work with the teachers and they'll work with the community members in the area. So it should work well.
So what happens with this program?
Well, we're putting together... we're actually training people up to go out and consult and work with teachers and the students, the children, through discussions, consultations. Trained people can recognise signs where a person is not openly but subconsciously responding to something that has caused them stress, anxiety or trauma. The two people involved here is one of our board members, a Professor Brett McDermott, and his colleague Vanessa Cobham. They did this work up in Queensland after the floods, and we don't go in until about 6 or 8 weeks after the event. Why? Because a lot of people are on the ground at the time. There's a lot of movement. There's a lot of activity. When the media withdraw, once the immediacy of the trauma is over, that is when often a lot of these difficulties start to settle in, trying to rebuild, looking at the results of the tragedy. So if you're looking at the effects of flood, if you're looking at the effects of fire, those signs, those symbols can then start eating into a person's persona, and constant reminders of what they've experienced, the frightening experience that they've had, can lead to more serious forms of depression. So we'll probably be in there for 6 months or so. It's going to cost about $650,000. Beyond Bull put up about $250,000, and the balance will come from the money raised by the community, often through the Red Cross, which we think is a very good use of that money, because at the end of the day, the most important thing we have is the condition of the human soul, the condition of our people. And we can repair fences, we can get the pastures to grow again, but importantly, we need to make sure that the condition of the human soul is, whatever normal is, as normal as possible.
So you have these people going in and consulting with the classes and with the children, with the teachers, and recognising the signs. What's actually the next step, though? What's actually being done to help those kids once it's recognised this child has an issue, this child needs help?
Where a child has been identified with issues, then the normal consultation that would take place by a psychologist or, if necessary, a psychiatrist will take place. So, as you can appreciate, and this has been the greatest change that's happened over the last 12 years with Beyond Blue and depression generally, a lot of people suffer and suffer in silence and don't feel comfortable with reaching out for help.
Well, in fact, that's really one of the signs of depression, is that you think nothing can help you with your problem.
In many cases, but it's also a fear of declaring your hand, being seen as a failure by others because you're depressed. It's not an illness that you can identify with easily because you don't have a broken arm or something like that. So it's a very difficult illness. But what we're trying to do is educate people who are behaving abnormally to their norm to seek help. Now, the same happens with these children. They may not be declaring that they've got an issue. Just because a child's becoming a little more reclusive or aggressive doesn't necessarily mean to many around them that they're responding to a trauma. But the professionals can identify that. And what takes place then, Joel, is consultation. As I said, we might be in the field for 6 months. we might, with some children, be in the field for a year, maybe longer. And that's the normal work of psychologists and psychiatrists, probably more psychologists initially, to actually help these people deal with the things that are causing them stress, in the same way that happened with as an adult. But with children, when they're suffering, if you can ease their burden earlier, if you can help give them the tools to deal with the things that cause them anxiety and stress, you're probably substantially reducing the time, the period of suffering that they'll go through over many years.
What can you mentioned earlier, when the media withdraw, that's when there's a chance to come in. Is there something the media should be doing around these things as well?
No, I don't think so. It's very natural. For instance, sadly, this morning we've woken up to the news that there's been some sort of bombing at the end of the Boston Marathon. Three people that I'm aware of lost their lives, many more injured. When there is a fire, when there is flood, the extremity of the event, the destruction, the media rush in and they cover it. So people are responding to the media, to the activity, to the immediacy of the issue. It's only when the immediacy of the flood or the fire is over, and then people start to have to pick up the pieces and repair the damage, and they look at their house burnt down, or they look at their house that has been totally wrecked through water, that the real pain often starts to kick in. We can all respond well to a television camera shoved in our face and said, oh, how are you responding? Oh, we're fine, we'll manage this. When there's no one there asking questions, when you're on your own, when all your neighbours are dealing with their issues, and you see the enormity of what you've been through, that's when pain, combined with the impact of the actual event, can itself cause the worst damage. So, no, the media, I think the media have been, generally speaking, very good in terms of helping us change community attitudes to depression. The beautiful thing about the work of Beyond Blue, it's been bipartisan. There's no politics. It's the most wonderful thing I've ever been part of in my life. And I say that seriously. I might criticise Julia Gillard on her policies, but she and I might talk on mental illness, and we're as one. And it's because there is a better understanding in the community.
Jeff Kennett there, the chairman of Beyond Blue on 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania. Coming up after the 9 o'clock news, we're going to be having a chat to a lung specialist about the impact of wood smoke on your lungs. My name is Joel Reinberger. I'm filling in for Leon Compton just for today. We've already had a few texts come in today. One says, sad that politicians can cooperate so well on human values like mental health and depression, but that's where it seems to end. From David. From a different David in Gilston Bay, talking about the abortion issue, to put it down to mere confusion is simply misleading. The bill massively widens the ground and period for getting an abortion up to 40 weeks. This is barbaric. It is not mere change to the criminal code. Thank you for that, David. An SMS has come in from Kelly from Blackwood Creek. She's more or less managed to include the amount of text of an email. Watching Dick Adams on Q&A last night was as cringeworthy as Pierce Brosnan in Mamma Mia. Great opportunity to make people aware of the real issues and promote positive action to address them was lost. An unnecessary focus on the start on Tony Abbott promoting David Marr's new book about him. Dick Adams being completely irrelevant and not actually answering questions asked of him. Jan Davis spoke well and made some great points, especially on the caged egg issue. I bet most people wouldn't get it, as Jan said. People buy on price. Thank you very much for that one, Kelly. If you'd like to SMS, 0438 922 936 is the number to get hold of us this morning. There are a couple of different mobs of government looking into wood smoke and the effect of wood smoke on us. There is a Senate inquiry into the impact of air quality on health going on at the moment. There is also the COAG Standing Council on Environment and Water, seeking public submissions for their consultation regulation impact statement for reducing emissions from wood heaters. How's that for the the start of your paperwork for a day. The consultation regulation impact statement for reducing emissions from wood heaters. So government is quite concerned about wood heaters. Apparently there's over a million of them in Australia, and about what effect they are having on our health and our lungs. Joining me now is Dr. James Marcos, who is a lung specialist. Dr. Marcos, good morning to you.
Good morning, Joel.
Now, how much wood smoke is okay and how much is not?
Now, that's a very good question, Joel. In fact, there is no safe limit of wood smoke, absolutely none whatsoever. But like anything, the more there's there, the more there is a problem. So, you know, the practical thing is to keep it down as low as you can.
How do you test something to the point where you can say no safe limit?
Well, people have measured wood smoke and particle pollution in many cities across Australia and the world, and people compare that with health outcomes, and no one has yet found a level where you can say that it is safe. It's similar to tobacco smoke. We know that even passive smoking is not safe, whereas there are other things like alcohol, a low amount of alcohol, I'm not promoting that, but a low amount of alcohol can be safe. So it's quite different to other things that we're concerned that in excess they're bad. With tobacco smoke and wood smoke, no one has found any safe level.
What sort of things are in wood smoke that are causing lung problems?
Well, there's two major components. One is the actual particles. You know, you can actually see these things, like
it's the smoke you actually see.
Yeah, the smoke you actually see, the actual particles. Yeah, they're very small particles, and they're measured in microns, you know, a millionth of a sort of a metre. So they're very tiny. And so that's one thing. And they're irritants. So, you know, it's just their physical characteristics are there. They block the very tiny sort of airways and air sacs. They take up space where the air should be. But in addition to that, there are some very active toxics, some of which are called the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. And these are some of these toxic things that also come out of tobacco smoke, and they can irritate the airways. And over a long period of time, there's also concern that they could cause lung cancer in non-smokers, although we know that the main cause of lung cancer is tobacco smoking.
So is there no definitive link between, you know, wood smoke and lung cancer, or is it more of a tendency that you see over a wide population?
Well, going back a step, we know that tobacco smoking is the main cause of lung cancer, but we still see lung cancer in a small proportion of non-smokers. And so of the overall people who get lung cancer, about 10 or 15% are non-smokers. One of the contributions of that is passive smoking. One of those is radiation. One is just bad luck and genetics, you know, more likely to get cancers anywhere. But a study did show, a very large study of 500,000 people in the United States, followed people over a 16-year period, and they concluded in 2002 that long-term exposure to wood smoke is an important environmental risk factor for dying from heart or lung disease or lung cancer, and that was after comparing them for their smoking rate. So they ruled that out as the cause.
So what does it do to your heart then?
That's a very interesting question. So the lung link is pretty obvious. You're breathing it in. Mm. The heart link, it doesn't go directly to the heart, but you know, when you breathe these things in, the body mounts an immune response to these toxins. It's trying to get rid of things, and that's a process we call inflammation in the body. And then the body sends out all these signals via the bloodstream, and these cells that are carrying the immune response then just seem to be able to incite a response in the blood vessels, and the blood vessels get inflamed, and the platelets get more sticky, and blood clots can occur. So it's a complex mechanism that's not fully known, but it has been investigated even down to a sort of a cellular level and in animal experiments, and there's a definite link there that can be shown.
What about smoke particles that land on roofs? I mean, in a place like Hobart, or more especially, I think, Launceston, which is in a valley, and smoke tends to stay there for a long time. The smoke eventually is going to drift down onto a roof and then go into drinking water. Is that smoke dangerous for us as well?
Well, you're thinking very laterally there, Joel. I mean, I don't know if that's been well studied. I think there's, from my knowledge, more broadly, I think there's more concern there about things like bird excreta and biological hazards in sometimes drinking water and algae that grows in things. But I don't know if that's been looked at. But it's good that you're thinking very laterally.
Yeah, look, I just remember after the bushfires, there was a specific warning that came out saying you should block the intake to your water tank until there's been a rain or two to wash all the smoke from the bushfires off your roof.
Yes, of course, there's a lot of ash. Of course,
Yeah, so, and I thought maybe, you know, especially over years, you live in a house that gets smoke on the roof every night of the winter for 20 years, maybe you're washing a significant amount of smoke into your drinking water. So just a thought. Look, do you have a wood heater in your home?
I do not burn wood, Joel, definitely not.
And you know, what would be your angle on, you know, there's, as I said, there's two separate government inquiries going on into wood heaters. Would you just be for banning it altogether?
No, I don't think that is the approach. I mean, you know, it's in the same way that we haven't banned tobacco altogether. I mean, people choose to smoke. It's almost 20% of Australians. A lot of people choose to burn wood. It becomes a problem for those people who have lung disease and heart disease. So, and that's whether they burn wood or not, which is why there's an extra responsibility. This is an important point, which is why there is this important role for government. I mean, you can choose to not smoke. Governments help us to have smoke-free places. But if you're a non-smoker who lives in a valley where wood is being used by a lot of people, you're going to be exposed to wood smoke whether you want to or not. And you're powerless to do anything about it unless you move residents, which is not recommended. So that's why governments have got an important role. But like anything, you know, we like to live and let live, you know. So people who live out in rural areas who wish to burn wood seems ideal. There's not a lot of people, you know, especially if you live on the coast somewhere, there's good wind supply to disperse it. But in valleys like the Tamar Valley in Launceston, there's similar problems in Canberra, in the Tuggeranong Valley, and in Armidale with the New England Plateau there. There are populated inland valleys that are cold where you've got to heat your home. I mean, if you don't heat your home, you're going to die sooner of, you know, freezing to death.
Yeah. Having lived in Canberra, I can tell you that's true.
Yes. So but there are healthier options, and so it's good to work towards electrical heating or gas heating. If you have to burn wood, I tell people to buy a pellet fire. These are these small pellets of wood that are compressed and they control release, and they give out the lowest emissions of all, you know, 1 gram per kilogram, whereas the current ones give up to 4 grams per kilogram. And there are trends now, that one of the COAG thing that you mentioned is report is looking very much at modifying the current regulations that we have as to the quality of wood heaters and their usage.
Now, look, you did mention one statistic a few minutes ago, which I found really interesting. You said 20% of Australians choose to smoke. As a lung specialist, does that not just drive you bonkers?
Really, I mean, I respect the fact that people make choices in life, you know, and it's all about a balance, I think. And to me, what is sad is it just shows the addictive power of tobacco and nicotine. I mean, nicotine has been found to be the most addictive substance on the planet, far more than heroin, for example. So, you know, it's sad that people get addicted, but they make their choices. I think it's very appropriate that we have all these efforts that government and others make to try and restrict children from being exposed so that they can make adult choices. But, you know, a teenager smoking can get addicted within a few months, and then that's it. They're addicted for life, you might say. Well, they can break the habit, but it's very hard to break the habit of tobacco smoking. So I try and assist people to quit smoking, or try and motivate them. But at the end of the day, I think I'm more concerned about people who make a profit out of this product, a legal product that causes human misery.
Dr. James Marcos, thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Dr. James Marcos is a lung specialist.
Hello, I'd like you to join me, Louise Saunders, for a community conversation about learning to drive this afternoon from 4. What are the costs of getting your licence? Is it becoming too expensive? How does your family handle the learner's need to spend 50 hours practising? What does it cost you in time and petrol? What if you don't have a car? And what are the social and safety consequences of not being able to get a licence? Join the conversation with our panel of experts, as well as hear people's own experiences. You can follow us online, on air and on Twitter.
You're listening to 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania Statewide Mornings with Joel Reinberger this morning. The news that's been on all our screens this morning is about the explosions at the end of the Boston Marathon. There is a mobile number for DFAT. If you have family or friends in Boston, you can call the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade on 0409 862 228. That's 0409 862 228. If you'd like to communicate with us this morning and join the conversation, you can SMS 0438 922 936. Carol says, is there anything people can do about wood smoke from a neighbour's wood heater causing them breathing problems? Shut your windows and stay inside, I guess, is the only thing I can think of immediately, Carol. I guess that's why there's these inquiries, because your neighbour's smoke does affect you. Last week in northwest Taz, smoke from Forestry Taz Clearfall and Burn blanketed the area, exceeding the guidelines by a factor of four. Why is the health minister ignoring this? Says Ian. Ian also says the Chinese president should feel quite at home when he visits Tasmania, with pollution from clear falling and burning mimicking the skies of Chinese cities. Stephen says, how about wood-smoked meat? I guess wondering if wood-smoked meat is bad for you or not. On the phone, and you can give us a call on 1300 222 936, is Basil in Launceston. Good morning, Basil.
Good morning, Joel. Joel, earlier on, Tony McCall made a comment about governments in their voting pattern regarding the controversial issues, whether the election is just 12 months out or whether it's 6 months out. They're not making decisions for the good of the people. They're making decisions for their own self-gain. Anything controversial. Now, let's have a look at some of them. And I believe strongly that we're going to have, because of the lack of quality in our parliamentary system, that we're going to have a referendum on forestry, on same-sex marriage, on euthanasia, on abortion, on donations to political parties, abolishment of the Legislative Council. All these are very controversial issues. Most have passed the lower house and rejected by the upper house. Now, that resolves nothing because you've got one side of the community saying this should happen. You've got the Legislative Council saying, well, we've made a decision because they are in an insidious position, or a very good position, really, of no one can get rid of the upper house. They're a power unto themselves.
Oh, I'm sure they do get voted in and out, Basil. We can all get rid of the upper house if we don't like them.
No, well, take this week. You've got three elections. They stagger them over a period of years where they only, instead of them all-out elections, which is what Tom Baxter's angling for, and we all are, they should all go out at the same time, and the same time as the lower house, now, every 4 years.
The other statement you made earlier was about, you know, the poor quality of the parliament. We do the voting. Don't we get exactly the parliament we deserve?
Well, because we've got no choice. It's what under the two-party system, we've got what the party puts up, the pre-selection.
Look, I think it's been shown in Australia that it is possible to have, well, in fact, even now, we have a third party in the Greens exerting, you know, a reasonable amount of power. We have independents exerting quite a lot of power. You know, and, you know, if we go back 10 years, the Democrats were holding quite a lot of balance there as well. I don't think we're always a two-party state. I think, you know, a two-party, you know, system. I think more parties are possible, you know.
Yes. I agree with your statement. But, you see, you've got to get enough of them in. For instance, take the present federal parliament, the way both parties, in my opinion, well, the leader of the opposition and the leader of the government, and the way in which the parliament's been performing over there, you've got to put a block in the Senate to make sure that not one party, in my opinion, this is my opinion, and the way I'll be voting, I'll tell you that now, I don't want either of those parties controlling the whole of Parliament and putting through legislation that one side or the other can just steamroll straight through Parliament. And it's got down to the point down here where the quality, and this is where McKim is dead right, about bringing these 16, 17-year-olds into the parliamentary system and voting, because they are brighter now, Joel, than what we were, or I was, not you, you're younger. I'm 76, so back in my day, we didn't have computers and all these sorts of things rolling around. I've got two grandchildren as bright as buttons, and building on computers and all houses and all this, and they're only very young. And this is where the older people are not catching up. The younger generation are coming through quicker, Joel, and they are bright, Joel, and very good. But
good on, Basil.
We've got to have a referendum, Joel, to fix the whole problems in this state. The state's divided far too much, Joel.
Good on you, Basil. Thanks for your call this morning. Phillips and Hobart, you got some thoughts about Q&A from last night?
Good morning, Joel.
Good morning.
I wanted to comment on the comments by Jan Davis because I think they're very instructive about Tasmania's future success or failure.
Yep.
And she made a comment about egg farming, and she said because we're going to introduce higher standards, animal welfare standards for animals, that's going to damage the industry. And the other thing she said was that 82% of people buy eggs on the basis of price. And this is the critical point. 18% of people don't. And there are the opportunities for Tasmania, not in the bulk production, but in the high-end, niche-end production. And for the critical reason that when you're in the high-end, niche production area, where there's plenty of scope for Tasmania to make wealth, is where you set the price, where you have a great capacity to set the price of what you earn, rather than being subject to the bulk market and the lowest common denominator. And I think this is a critical point about where Tasmania goes forward. Are we going to try and compete, as we've done with wood chips, in the bulk markets, accepting the lowest price? Or are we going to set ourselves with a brand and a high quality, high animal welfare and say, we produce the best eggs, you pay for them, because 18% of the market's already prepared to do that. And it disturbs me that the head of the TFGA doesn't understand that the real future for Tasmania is in high quality, high end, where we can have the greatest influence on setting the price.
I actually see that philosophy going ahead with a bunch of the small supermarkets around Tasmania at the moment, especially in Hobart. There's about half a dozen little grocers who are just doing beautiful stuff, doing really, really beautiful stuff. And, you know, some of the stuff from their deli is more expensive, but it's beautiful, and so a lot of people are happy to pay for it. And there's half a dozen different ones run by different people all doing the same thing. So I think you have an interesting point there, Philip.
Well, if we're going to step into the Asian market as well, the middle class of Asia, high-end, high-quality, gives us plenty of opportunity to find wealth. But if we want to compete in the sort of bulk production, $2, $2.50 at Coles, Woolworths for eggs, we're going to lose out because we won't be able to compete. So I think this is a critical feature of where Tasmania sets its economy and our policy, that it's the high-end niche that's going to deliver Tasmania well.
Good on you, Philip. Thank you for your call today.
Thanks, Joel.
Catherine's in Claremont. Hello, Catherine.
Oh, hello, Joel. Thank you for taking my call about secondhand smoke. I am a non-smoker who has to endure secondhand smoke in public bus shelters and in the northern suburbs in Glenorchy. Very politely, I told somebody that it wasn't allowed, and they said, oh, but they've got to catch me. Now, we have to put up with it because there's nowhere else you can wait for a bus. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Catherine. Nice point. I guess you have to call in the authorities if it comes down to that sometimes. It's 26 past 9 on 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
On 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania, you're listening to Joel Reinberger.
And seeing all the commentary about the Boston Marathon, the explosions that have happened there, probably the most inspired comment I've seen about it is from George Takei, the actor who you may remember as playing Mr. Sulu off the original Star Trek series. He's become an internet phenomenon, George, and millions of people follow him on Facebook, and he often does, you know, cute, funny things, but this is lovely. When tragedies strike, heroes rise to meet the challenge. The first responders seen sprinting towards the blast site, the runners who changed course to run to local hospitals to donate blood, and the fine citizens of Boston who at once opened their homes to marathoners in need of a place to stay. When we come together, we cannot be brought down. That's George Takei there on his Facebook feed. Always worth reading is George. Also coming into the studio is a lot of your comments on the SMS, 0438 922 936. Trevor in Kettering says, good morning, Joel. Some of your listeners should be very happy as we live in a wonderful free country. We are very lucky. Yes, we are, Trevor. Charlie responds to Basil and says, young ones may be bright, Basil, but are they wise? Lucy says, hi, Joel. If the amendments go through, there will be no agreement, no money for industry, no environmental protection. It took 3 years to reach an agreement. What a shame the LegCo couldn't just let that agreement stand. Thank you, Lucy. Deborah from Longford says, watched Q&A last night. What a gabble of nothing from Dick Adams. I agree with Kelly. And Greg Gibson at Hagley says, Jan Davis was brilliant last night on Q&A. No farmers, no food, no future. Australians shouldn't forget that. We are being squeezed like never before. Thank you for that, Greg. If you'd like to join in the conversation on the SMS, 0438 922 966 is the number. Or you can call 1300 222 936, as Ray from Launceston has done. Hello, Ray. You watched Q&A as well?
Yeah, bits of it. What Jan Davis said regarding the eggs was that the caged hens' egg production will finish at the end, or will be phased out at the end of June, I believe. What she also said was that it's the only state it's happening, and we'll be bringing in the caged hens' eggs from mainland Australia, which doesn't make a lot of sense in the sense that...
defeats the point a little, perhaps.
Beg your pardon?
It defeats the point a little, perhaps.
That's exactly it. And if you want, by all means, grow free-range eggs for those who can afford those sort of things and pay premium prices. But I think you've got to cater for the majority of people who live from day to day, who use caged eggs, caged hen's eggs. It doesn't make a lot of sense that we would be importing them from mainland Australia, and the people that are in the industry now would be out of a job in Tasmania. But that's about the Tasmanian psyche sometimes, I think.
Thank you for that, Ray. Peter is in Prospect. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to talk on pretty much the same issue. I think while on the face of it, Jan Davis's argument about caged eggs makes sense, the practicalities of it sort of belie why these sorts of changes are necessary, because we can't put up trade barriers within Australia to stop bringing caged eggs into Tasmania, because you can't have trade barriers within a country. So we'd really just never get an animal welfare outcome by her logic, because you've got to always get the whole country coming together, or none at all.
And we're just sort of exporting the animal rights issue is I guess what's going on.
Well, I think we are for the moment. I think if Tasmania does it, then maybe some other states will follow. And sometimes people have to be a bit brave. But to pick up on what Stephen from Hobart said earlier about Tasmania's opportunities being in niche, higher margin quality, I think Tasmania is really missing an opportunity. And I'd like to hear Jan Davis talk a lot more about this, because there's so much great food here. And I talk about this as someone who came to Tasmania from the mainland many years ago, and part of my quality of life here is just how well I can eat. But it doesn't make it to market at those premium prices, because the market is just pinned down by middlemen and gatekeepers, and I'm mostly talking about the supermarket duopoly, who I think don't have a lot of interest in selling the Valhalla ice creams and the Tamar Valley yogurts and that kind of thing onto the mainland, because it's just easier for them to sell a low-quality product in a nice container at a high price. And I'd like to see a lot more help being given to brand Tasmania and to get our products to where the money is in Melbourne and Sydney and elsewhere, so our farmers can reap some of that benefit.
Well, I think that you sort of hit the problem with that on the head, is that it doesn't really matter how much brand Tasmania does to make people think our stuff is great, if it's impossible for it to be carried in the main supermarkets, which is where these things are being bought by the majority of people.
I think one simple thing I'd like to see, and I can't understand why every Tasmanian politician should be pounded on this, is get proper labelling onto food products in the supermarket. I mean, you can buy a packet of nuts, nothing but nuts in it, that says made from imported and local ingredients. People in Melbourne and Sydney and elsewhere, the people with the money, they want to buy Tasmanian, and we need to get Tasmania onto labels. And I don't think it's too offensive to free trade principles to try and get Coles and Woolworths to tolerate that.
Good on you, Peter. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
That's Peter in Prospect there on 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania. Andrew McIntosh is the Associate Director for the ANU Centre for Climate and Law Policy, who's put out a very interesting report on Tasmania's forest industry. He joins us now. Good morning to you. How are you doing?
Very well.
Now, your latest report says that the state and federal government shouldn't throw good money after bad in the way of industry packages. Do you think that there is no future for the forestry industry here?
Well, at the moment, if you just concentrate on the native forest sector, I think they're looking down the barrel. I think if you look objectively at the evidence on the state of its key markets, it is looking very bleak for the native forest sector. And while there is a chance it might recover on the back of growing chip demand in China and potentially through biomass markets, I think that's only a slight chance. And so I think both state and federal governments have to ask themselves, firstly, is it their role to try and direct the economy? So basically, should it be subsidising industry? And if yes, is continuing to subsidise the forestry sector the best place to invest our money and the best place and the best way to try and encourage economic activity in Tasmania?
Let's talk a bit about the market. What is the market for that forestry product?
Well, in Tasmania, the main market has been for the last 20 years wood chips, and wood chip sales to Japan has been the primary source of revenue for the native forest sector. And unfortunately for the sector, they've seen a major downturn. It's been a downward trend over the last two decades, basically, but the last 5 years has seen an acute drop, and that's been a product of a combination of factors. Firstly, everybody knows about the global financial crisis. We've also seen a very sharp appreciation of the Australian dollar. But in the background to all that, there's been a series of structural factors. And by that I mean, firstly, on the supply side, they've been facing very strong competition from domestic plantations. So there's been an absolute ballooning of plantations, hardwood plantations in Australia, primarily as a result of tax subsidies, but also investors thought there'd be the prospect of ongoing wood chip exports to Japan. And that competition, they've wedged out the native forest sector and stolen market share off them in the Japanese market. Also, more recently, we've seen an unbelievable increase in plantation wood chip supply out of Vietnam and Thailand.
Now, does that mean they were planting those, you know, 10, 15 years ago to you know, or longer than that even, to have that product out now?
The rotation length in Southeast Asia is quite staggering. We've had reports of rotation lengths of only 3 years. So they only need 3 years plantation time. So literally 3 years ago they plant them and then they harvest them 3 years later.
Wow.
So truly staggering. And they're now supplying. Vietnam is now the world's largest wood chip exporter and Thailand is now the third largest. In Vietnam, the chip exports have increased by over 2,000% in the last decade. In Thailand, it's been an almost 700% increase. So they can produce chips cheaper than us, they can produce them in shorter rotation, and the supply, the market, the pulp producers prefer plantation chips because they have higher yields. And the other advantage they have over us is that the shipping time is so much shorter. They can get to China and Japan in 1 to 2 days. It takes us sort of 10 to 14 days to do the same trip. So they've got a lot of advantages over us. And with the high Australian dollar at the moment, it's just making the business much harder for all Australian plantation chip suppliers. Sorry, not only plantation, but also native forest. So there's a lot of problems in that market, just on the supply side, but also on the demand side. The pulp and paper industry in Japan is in the decline, and that is because most of the pulp and paper produced in Japan is used in their domestic market. And over the last while, they've seen quite a sharp decrease in per capita consumption of paper, and also population in Japan is also in decline. So,
paper consumption around the first world, we hope should be going down in terms of the number of screens people have instead.
Yeah, that's right. New technologies like iPads. You know, you wouldn't have thought 5 years ago that sort of technology could have a big impact, but it has. And also with the global financial crisis, you saw a big shift in the way that businesses operate in Japan, and they found themselves in quite acute economic circumstances, and as a result, they have changed their businesses, and that's seen a big shift in paper consumption in Japan as well. So, the, you know, for the domestic industry, they're facing a situation where, particularly from Tasmania, they were very dependent on chip exports to Japan. All of a sudden, they see the situation where they're facing sharp increase in competition from others and a downturn in the market itself. So the industry in Tasmania is really looking down the barrel, and if they don't see an uptake in demand from China, or they can start supplying biomass markets in primarily in Europe, then I fear that the industry will collapse completely.
Now, certainly a large part of the conversation about forestry in Tasmania is about the damage done to forestry by the environmental movement. How much do you see the environmental movement being responsible for the issues with forestry or with damage to the forestry markets?
I don't think you can say they've done nothing, but I think it's marginal. This is one of those issues that's been right at the margins. I think what happened in the global financial crisis is the Japanese pulp and paper companies turned around and said, look, we can't produce what we've previously been producing, and therefore we have to cut supply. What's the place that's most controversial? Tasmania is the one that's at the top of the list. Let's cut it. We can source chips that are less controversial and are cheaper potentially from elsewhere. We'll go with them. I think that's the sort of role that the environment movement has played in this process, but it's not a big factor. You're now seeing a downturn in plantation chips from Australia as well, and you've seen a downturn in chip exports from, say, CEFI in New South Wales. So that's the major chip producer in New South Wales that also exports native chips. So it's not only Tasmania. You've seen it elsewhere. And now the contagion is spreading to other parts of the forestry sector.
Look, it's an interesting sounding a document that you've made. Where can people have a look at that, Andrew?
It's on the Australia Institute website, and if anyone has any questions or would like to see a copy of the report or they're struggling to get it, just type in my name, that's Andrew McIntosh, into Google and it'll come up. Send me an email and I'm very happy to send it to them or answer any questions.
Andrew McIntosh, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Andrew McIntosh is Associate Director for the ANU Centre for Climate Law and Policy on 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
While I was farting on one occasion, I could hear a strange crack every now and then. That is a bullet. It breaks the sound barrier as it goes past you, and if it's close, the crack is deep inside. Somebody was firing at my head.
The lesser-known side of gardening legend Peter Kundal, telling of his days as a Korean War infantry soldier. Just one of the voices joining me, Michael Veitch, across Australia this Anzac Day evening. I do hope you can join us on ABC Local Radio and streaming online from 7 p.m.
Brian is in Launceston. Hello, Brian. How are you doing?
Good morning, Joel. Very interested in Andrew McIntosh. Last year, when I was walking down to my chiropractor on Elphin Road, I turned around and met Bill Manning. And Bill was going to the same man. Now, Bill, you might recall, was a noted forester in Tasmania and held a high position, gave Evans the Senate inquiry of what the problems were, and... But, of course, the powers that be in Tasmania took no notice of him. He gave the same opinion that Andrew McIntosh did. He had just come back from a trip to Asia and Hao Vibay in Vietnam, and that they were growing the trees, and that was the problem. But, of course, you wouldn't read about that in the local press in Tasmania. The second thing I'd like to raise with you, Joel, is what Basil raised, because when I go on these walks of the morning, I'd meet these young students going to Newstead College and the young students walking to Scotch College, and they are quite intelligent young people. And what I'm not a Green member or anything like that. They're not in my politics. But one thing I must say, in fairness to Mr. McKim, he was reported totally incorrectly in the Examiner. What he said, it was optional. Now, if they elected these young kids, 16, 17, that they wanted to vote because of their intelligence, then it was optional. It wasn't that every 16 and 17-year-old kid would have to do that. And there's a very good article in today's Examiner by Mr. Peter Lloyd of Trevallon. And he's stating that our kids, or our grandchildren, these young people I talk to, they will be competing against people in Asia who are in my generation, the downtrodden, but they are now becoming the type of people they've got to compete against. And here we are, and as it say, he says this, one only needs to read the Examiner, only the pages, to find endless examples of older Australians betraying complete ignorance on everything from climate science to broadband policy. Some of them are MPs and senators. It reminds me of an old saying, a Second World War soldier said to me, "I'm all right, Jack, bugger the rest."
Good on you, Brian. That's Brian in Launceston there on 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a bell on 1300 222 936, or you can SMS 0438 922 936. Joining us now is Dr. David Mallett from the School of Political and Social Science at the University of Melbourne to talk about the explosions that happened in Boston this morning. Dr. Mallett, good morning to you.
Hi, Joel. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Now, look, what can you tell me about where these explosions are from?
Well, the location of the explosions was pretty close to the finish line area. It's an area in Boston that it's a couple of major universities, some major shopping areas, a very popular place to go to watch the end of the marathon. Very crowded area. It appears that the explosions went off in the crowd from what I'm reading, so it looks like somebody left four devices in different locations. Two of them went off. Two of them they caught before they went off. And the police are now trying to figure out who might have done it.
Now, what are your thoughts on who might have done it?
Everybody's first reaction is this is Al-Qaeda. This is foreign terrorism. We don't know. It could very well be. My suspicion is it's going to be a domestic terror attack. This week in the U.S., there are a lot of interesting things, unfortunate interesting things that happen altogether. It's tax day right now in the U.S., which brings out a lot of the right-wing anti-government types. It's Patriot Day in Massachusetts. That's why they have the marathon. It's the anniversary of the beginning of the Revolutionary War against the British, which many see as a need to fight against government as well. It's the anniversary in a couple of days as well, Patriot Day, with the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, various other sort of uprisings, if you want to call them that, by domestic terror groups, militant groups. I'm guessing that's the inspiration for this. Boston's also sort of emblematic of the left in America, kind of like San Francisco or New York, and it's fairly close to Newtown, the city where the mass shooting was in December. So I wouldn't be surprised if someone was trying to send a signal about perhaps gun legislation in the U.S. right now.
I can't really understand what they would be trying to achieve with this. I can sort of understand someone who targets a government building or something like that, but what would a group like that hope to get out of, basically blowing up a bunch of joggers?
Yeah, government buildings are hard to get into these days. In Boston, you have to go through security checks, sign in with your driver's license. A crowded place is a good target of opportunity for whoever was responsible for this. It's certainly, one of the world's major sporting events will get you media attention, global media attention. You're covering it in Hobart.
But what sort of media attention? I can't understand what positive thing would happen for that organization out of doing this. I can't understand how an anti-government group gets anything besides people hating them for something like this.
Terrorists always see themselves as basically altruists who are forced to do, a necessary evil. They believe that you're not going to cover their grievances, that the world is stacked against them, so that they have to get attention for their cause any way they can. And yes, people are going to hate them initially, but their issues will start to get attention in the media, and then people, they believe, will begin to see the justice of their cause and start to sympathize with them. It's the same rationale that was given by the shooter in Norway a couple of years ago, by other domestic terrorists in the U.S., and even by Al-Qaeda.
Now, what do you think are going to be the consequences of this action? What's next year's Boston Marathon going to be like?
It's hard to imagine at this point. I went to Boston University. I lived right next to the route. Back in the 90s, you could even leave parked cars there. I imagine security is going to be intense, that the streets will be cleared of certainly parked vehicles. There might be security screenings to get anywhere near the parade route. Of course, marathons go 26 miles, so it's hard to secure that entire route. But Washington, D.C. has the Marine Corps Marathon coming up in October, the New York Marathon, Los Angeles, all the major cities in the U.S. have marathons. It's really hard to imagine how you can secure
42 kilometres of running route. That's a lot of area to keep clear. Well, Dr. David Mallett from Uni of Melbourne, thank you for being with us this morning.
Thanks, Joel.
You're on 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania. Tourism is down in the West Coast, but aquaculture is about to undergo a rapid expansion there. And what does that mean for tourism? Can accommodation owners sell or rent to fish farmers? Will some tourist accommodation be sold and possibly lost to that industry? Will there be jobs for tourism industry people on the farms? Reporter Rick Eaves spoke to Adam Main, CEO of the Tasmanian Salmonid Growers Association, about all of those things, as well as cruise boat skipper Andy Marshall and accommodation owner Cherie Crane, both of who say that the exchange between tourism and fish farming is already well developed.
I'm speaking with Adam Main. He's the CEO of the Tasmanian Salmonid Growers Association. Adam, tell me, where is the expansion of fish farming on Macquarie Harbour at?
Yeah, look, the companies have all been given the approval from both the state and the federal government, and we're now working on receiving that approval to figure out the next steps with the state government.
What would the timeline be? Do you have any idea there?
Yeah, look, we'd like to see some new fish in the water within the next years. Probably see more activity spring to summer.
Things are not so good in tourism. I'm just wondering how the aquaculture industry and the tourism industry can come together with those things. Accommodation, obviously, is failing in some cases for operators in Strawn. Is there going to be a demand from the fish farms for those sort of properties?
Yeah, look, I'll just start by, I suppose, saying that the salmon industry has got a great respect for the tourism industry in Tasmania, but also specifically over there in Strawn and Macquarie Harbour. Yeah, look, there's at any point in time, there's a lot of people from the salmon industry staying in Strawn, and with the expansion underway in Macquarie Harbour, that's only going to increase.
Cherie, you mentioned the fish farms are picking up some of the slack left by the downturn in tourism. Are those businesses also looking to the tourism accommodation in Strawn as a way to house workers?
Well, they haven't actually got that far yet, Rick, but we've actually, in our little group called Discover Strawn, we're actually looking at that.
Would that mean that you would be housing them as you would house tourists, or would it be people selling to fish farms, do you think?
Probably a bit of both. There are a few accommodation places around for sale, so that would be a possibility there. Otherwise, yeah, we would look at working out an arrangement with them for overnight accommodation as well.
There are already a few, aren't there, that were B&Bs at one point and are now housing fish farmers?
That's right, there is. There was a few small operators that brought up individual homes that were overnight accommodation. Well, some of those now do house fish farm employees, yes.
Whenever I'm visiting Strawn, I'm staying in the local accommodation, and so are most of the people that own all the companies.
Do you think, will it be a case of looking to purchase properties to house fish farmers, or long-term lease agreements, or what's going to work?
No, look, for the indefinite future, it's still business as usual where we use the local accommodation.
So is that because it's a largely drive-in, drive-out workforce?
Yeah, look, we have a range of people going over to Macquarie Harbour, from farm managers, regional managers, to veterinary officers, to research officers. There's a whole range of different people that need to be moving backwards and forwards from Hobart or from up north to Strawn. And, all have different requirements in terms of time spent in Strawn. So it's quite a dynamic a need for the accommodation over there.
There was a forecast of 200 new jobs, is that correct?
Yeah, we're looking in the construction phase to get all the new pens in of 100 construction jobs over the next 5 years. And then that is, in addition to that, there's 163 operational jobs as well. So if you look at that, they're the direct jobs, but there's also going to be quite a significant increase in indirect jobs as a result of the expansion as well.
Will there be much scope for people working in tourism at the moment to get work on the farm expansions or on the new farms when they're developed?
Yeah, look, absolutely. We will have a focus in terms of seeking people for the positions over there in Macquarie Harbour as the construction needs and the future needs, to be sourcing people from the local area. In addition to those that might actually want to work with the farm specifically, there's also going to be the opportunity for people to make their own businesses around the fish farms. We also already have the tour boat operators utilising the farms as part of their boat trips up to the Gordons. So it's already a part of the tourism experience for Macquarie Harbour, but there'll be far more other opportunities going forward in the harbour.
People will often move between tourism, mining, fish farming, the major industries there. Do you know of many people who are working there at the moment who have made those sorts of moves?
Look, I think that the nature of the skill set that for those three that you'd mentioned, mining, tourism and fish farming, people with their qualifications, the coxswains and master fives and all the boat, the skippers of the boats, right through to the people with the technical skills about working on water. So they all share a very similar skill set. And I personally don't know of how many people move between, but I do know that it allows for that definitely to have that shared skill set.
Are there many people working in tourism who are starting to do a bit more casual work in aquaculture?
Well, I would be a prime candidate for that. Tourism is a job you do for enjoyment and a lifestyle, whereas it's not that well paying. And so I'm out there working in the whatever relief I can get out in the fish farms just to create a decent income.
That's reporter Rick Eves speaking to Adam Main, CEO of the Tasmanian Salmonid Growers Association, as well as cruise boat skipper Andy Marshall and accommodation owner Cherie Crane. Coming in on the text, from someone without a name, says people talk about using local fruit and veg shops, but don't take the extra 20 to 30 minutes to do so. Local shop has better and usually cheaper products. Take the time. Joel says, Danny, could you ask Peter Gutwin to respond to Andrew McIntosh? We might be able to try that. But first, it's at news time, 10 o'clock. Our phone number, if you'd like to call us, of course, is 1-300-222-936. And our SMS is 0438-922-936. We've got quite a few of those coming through. Nick says, MHAs are elected on party platforms. They are there to represent my views, not theirs. The only way to do that is by following party policy. Conscience votes should therefore remain rare. Jack says, under the jackboot leadership of Abbott, Abetz and Hodgman, our current egalitarian society and its voting system will be altered to suit the big end of town. Carol says, for goodness sake, why do we keep thinking everything from here is better than from other places? Hobart says, Ian from Hobart says, the supermarket shelves are stacked against us. Kay the trucker says, eggs do come into Tassie by the pallets. I see them weekly. Charlie in Kettering says, make up your mind. Yesterday we were getting rid of plastic bags and talking up paper packaging. Because, of course, today we're talking about less paper. Nicholas says, fascinating interview with Andrew McIntosh. Let's hope the LegCo dinosaurs were listening. And Mark in Devonport asks, hi, Joel, was Boston the city of origin where both planes took off in 9/11? I believe that is the case there, Mark. If you'd like to send us an SMS, 0438-922-936 is the number. If you'd like to see the SMSs, you can actually go to the front page of our website where we publish them. Over on the right-hand side, go to abc.net.au/Hobart or abc.net.au/North Tas. And you'll be able to see on the right-hand side your SMS, and you click on that button, it'll go to a page of all the most recent SMSs that we've been sent, that we put through and publish on the website, so you can see what people are talking about a little bit later in the day. Also, got an email through, tasmornings@your.abc.net.au is the address for that. This one is from Swan. I'm an asthmatic whose health is adversely affected each winter by a neighbour's wood smoke. Despite my best efforts, the smoke enters our house and I am powerless to do anything about it. I would welcome tougher emission standards for wood heaters plus active reinforcement of those standards, but I suspect pigs will fly before that occurs. If you've got any thoughts like that you'd like to share with us, please do tasmornings@your.abc.net.au. Coming up this hour on Statewide Mornings after 10:30, Sally Bryant from Land Conservancy with Wildlife Talkback. So if you've got a falcon you've seen or a possum you've tripped over that you'd like to talk to us about, you can give us a call after 10:30 to have a chat with Sally about that one. And look, I tell you what, I love getting photos for that. And you can just send them through to the SMS number and we can look at them here on that. So 0438 922 936, and I can show Sally the photo. So if you've got a photo of a bird you want identified or of something that you're particularly impressed by that you've seen in wildlife, then give us an SMS and send it through, or you can send it through on the email. Either way, I can actually show them to Sally here in the studio, which is always lovely. Up next, talking to Bernard Keane from crikey.com.au about Australian politics over the last week. SMS has come in from Nigel, who says, Joel, as a chimney sweep, I can say that a wood heater that is cleaned annually and burning dry wood, and he accentuates dry, will smoke very little. If not, it needs looking at. Look, I think that's absolutely right, Nigel, that good wood being burnt properly in a good heater is reasonably efficient and a reasonably efficient thing. But yeah, the problem is there's a lot of bad green wood that does get sold. I've certainly been sold a couple of loads of it in my 4 years or so that I was buying wood in Tasmania. And now, how's this for a segue to a man who's always smoking, Bernard Keane from crikey.com.au. Hello, Bernard. How are you doing?
I'm good, Joel. That's the worst segue of the week, if not of the month.
I'm proud of it nonetheless, because there was a segue at all. Now, look, you know, the news of the week in Australian politics, Bernard, robbing Peter to pay Gonski seems to be the big one. Do you think they're going to get away with it, or are the universities going to kick up a really massive stink?
Well, the getting away with it issue, I suppose, is a little bit beyond the sort of the immediate objective. I think the immediate issue is whether the Commonwealth's going to be able to get any states to sign up to their deal to actually channel that funding, some of that saved funding, into the Gonski funding mechanism. It's going to be an interesting budget because on the weekend, the Prime Minister seemed to say, look, we've got all our savings that we need for Gonski. We don't need any more. But Craig Emerson seemed to say, no, they'd still be on the hunt for more savings. So the budget's going to be very interesting to see whether there are further savings that have got to be directed into Gonski and where it's going to come from, because my math suggests that it doesn't add up. They haven't found anywhere near enough savings to fund even what they announced on the weekend. And the particularly the efficiency dividend, which is, I think, really got the universities concerned, about $900 million over 4 years, which is not small bickies by anyone's reckoning. That's not an ongoing saving. That's not going to accrue year in, year out as the Gonski funding reforms roll out, if they ever do. That's just 2014 and 2015. So that's universities are going to be slugged that sort of 2.5% efficiency dividend over a couple of years. It's not going to be a long-term thing that's going to provide ongoing funding. So that means the numbers add up even less than they already do. And in that sense, this is a slug on universities that isn't going to actually directly benefit the Gonski funding sort of process. I mean, the logic of all this, certainly for the other savings measures they announced on the weekend, was this is all for Gonski. This is all, we're going to reallocate money from the tertiary sector to the secondary and primary sectors, in effect. And, yeah, sure, we'd all like there to be a magic pudding that will make sure we never have to cut spending in any area. But, you can argue the merits for that particular decision. But there just isn't enough money at the moment to fund what is going to be a fairly expensive exercise. And bear in mind, the spending that they announced for Gonski on the weekend is also well short of what the Gonski report actually recommended. It's only about $14.5 billion in total. And Gonski's recommendation was much closer. Well, it was over $30 billion in the long run. So it's always sort of good to see more money going to education, but this is well shy of what Gonski himself recommended. And the irony, of course, as you probably know, is that David Gonski now himself is a vice chancellor. He's a chancellor of a university. So he finds himself the target of funding cuts made in his name.
Now, Julia Gillard has been saying that this happens in a place where spending for universities has gone up hugely significantly. I think the figure I saw was 50% since 2007. So this is a little cut at the end of a large increase in spending on the tertiary sector. Does that add up? Does the maths to that add up?
We looked at that in Crikey yesterday, and our calculation, if you adjust the spending before 2007 in real terms, is that yes, the spending's gone up by about 45-46%. So the Prime Minister's not too far off on that. The problem is that during the Howard years, tertiary spending on higher education actually fell really significantly. I mean, it wasn't just a small fall; it wasn't just a spending being held solid in cash terms, but not indexed or anything like that. It actually fell quite markedly from the levels that the Keating government had left it in. So we're still not actually back to the levels of higher education funding that the Keating government had, despite the fact that that Julia Gillard, as their first education minister and then as prime minister, has pumped more money into higher education. So our universities are still shy of where they were. Of course, that funding, to an extent, the idea has been that that universities have made good that funding by being able to attract international students in our international education sector since the mid-90s has grown enormously. But in terms of the role of the Commonwealth in higher education, we're still well shy of where things were back in the what seems like 1,000 years ago when Paul Keating was running the country.
I tend to think that maybe it's all a bit of sound and fury signifying nothing, because if the states aren't going to cooperate, there's not much of this going to happen, is there?
Well, that's true, and we're probably not going to see any sort of outcomes on Friday when there's a COAG meeting on this. It's going to be interesting, though. There's an interesting decision awaiting the states on this, because the government has said, look, we want a $14.5 million package. We're prepared to offer $9.4 billion. You provide the rest. You guarantee that you're not going to that you are going to index education funding properly. You sign up to these reforms in terms of performance information and giving school principals greater decision making power, and we'll give you all this money. Now, the problem for the states is that there's no comparable. The coalition's saying, well, we're not going to put any more money into education. We don't think we need to spend more money on education. So if the Gillard government dies on September 14, then all that extra money that the states are being offered will die along with it. So the state, particularly the coalition states, have got to play a very difficult game here. They don't want to do anything that's going to make life easier for Julia Gillard. And if they all agree to the Gonski process, then she's going to trumpet that as a huge win. But if they don't sign up, then they are basically turning their backs on quite a significant increase in money, particularly New South Wales and Victoria. They're the big winners out of this because they're obviously the biggest states. But if they don't sign up by June 30, which is the deadline, then potentially they're doing themselves out of a couple of $1 billion of extra education funding. And that's going to be a tough sell to voters to explain why they just apparently, for the sake of politics, decided they didn't want to get some extra money for education.
So that's one that the government is still very much struggling with. One that, to my eye, the government appears to be winning is the PR war about the NBN. And I've got to say, it's pretty rare for the government to win a PR war. It's one of the things they're not terribly good at. But they are winning on the NBN, and partly that seems because Malcolm Turnbull, I mean, do you think he believes what he's selling?
Oh, look, Malcolm Turnbull has spent his life selling things that he doesn't necessarily personally believe in. So, I mean, this is a bloke who for a long time was a very successful lawyer, so let's not, I don't think there's a problem with the selling by Malcolm Turnbull. I think the problem is the product. It's a pretty good product compared to what the coalition has previously offered on broadband. I mean, this is the party that really would have preferred broadband to just disappear and go away. They just didn't want to have anything to do with it. Malcolm Turnbull has brought them to the point where they are prepared to spend billions of dollars building a fibre to the node network, and that's a big change compared to where the coalition used to be. The problem is, though, I think what's emerged from
the fact that the Coalition did release a policy and there was a lot of media coverage of it, I think that's meant that people have actually thought again about what they're getting with the NBN and thought about what Malcolm Turnbull's offering and thought, well, why don't we do it properly? Why don't we build the whole thing properly rather than just build it all the way to the end of our street? And I suspect that's one of the reasons why there's been two polls in the last couple of days on that issue, one from Fairfax and one that we ran yesterday in Crikey from Essential. Both showed basically the same thing. The NBN is just streets ahead, no pun intended, of the Coalition's plan in terms of public support, and that's a really telling sign about a government that as you say, has been quite poor in terms of being able to sell its message.
Now, did you get a copy of this high-speed rail report that came from Anthony Albanese?
I managed to download it eventually, despite the best efforts or worst efforts of the Department of Transport.
Government websites, don't you love them?
Government website. Department of Infrastructure is because when I worked there, it was the Department of Transport, but it's called something. You
know, infrastructure and Transport.
Funkier these days.
DIT.
Yeah, Infrastructure.
Oh, no, Department of Infrastructure and Transport, so DOIT.
Oh, don't worry, that place has been through all sorts of interesting acronyms over the years. It used to be called DOTARD, as in, you can actually look up DOTARD in the dictionary, you'll see that it means
an old person.
An old lunatic.
Yeah.
So that at times is quite relevant to the sorts of things we were doing there.
So this seems to say we can do this lovely train corridor and it'll cost $114 billion. Didn't we sort of already know that you can do a massive train project if you've got endless money to spend? Is there anything that's actually come out of this that means it's ever going to happen?
Well, hopefully not, because it'd be a staggeringly bad decision. I mean, look, there's been a long history of governments doing high-speed rail reports. Back in the 90s, there was a real flurry of interest in building a Canberra to Sydney high-speed rail project. There were reports done back then. They were funded by the ACT government, and at that stage, the ACT government was dead keen on a fast rail. So they got some consultants who basically sort of said, well, just tell us the result you want and we'll find the numbers to make it work. But even under the most heroic assumptions, they couldn't actually demonstrate that a Canberra to Sydney high-speed rail would ever actually be viable. This report, which is they spent about $20 million on, and it's taken a couple of years, does everything from what properties you'd need to buy, what the route alignment would be, right through to the financials. So it's a pretty thorough report.
For $20 million, you'd hope so.
Indeed, I think you want pretty good value for money for $20 million, and it's a pretty rigorous report. I mean, I've got some issues with some of the assumptions that they've ended up making, but certainly not with the quality of the work they've done. And the basic outcome of the report is: look, this thing ain't going to fly. Again, no pun intended. It's my day for bad puns. It costs so much money that, and I mean, I did a quick sort of back of the envelope calculation. I calculated you could fly everyone who currently flies on the routes that would be covered by the high-speed rail network. You could fly them for free for 25 years for $114 billion. So it's got this staggering cost. It's not going to earn back any money. It's not going to earn back that $114 billion. So it's not. A lot of people compare high-speed rail to the NBN. Well, the NBN is actually going to earn back its money and eventually generate a return to taxpayers, and eventually the government's going to sell off the network and make a handy profit. The high-speed rail network will never generate any money to cover its actual capital costs. All it will do at best is generate enough revenue to cover its operating expenses, which is, you know, a seriously bad investment. And, I mean, we've already got a very high-speed transport network between our major cities, and that's called aircraft. So, my hope is that this report, this comprehensive report, puts the nail on the coffin of high-speed rail. We don't have to endure debates about it anymore because... And why are we investing? Why are we prioritising those particular transport corridors? Why aren't we taking a more objective look at all of Australia's transport needs and trying to work out, what are the most urgent investments? I mean, I reckon the most urgent investments
probably lie in urban transport in Sydney and Melbourne, because we're suffering by about 2020 we'll be suffering about $20 billion a year worth of congestion costs. Now, it seems to me for a couple of billion bucks you could actually go a long way toward making a dent in those sorts of costs. Or if you're going to spend money on if you want to invest money in transport that isn't necessarily going to generate a substantial return, but which might have social benefits, well, you might look at further investment in the Bass Strait ferry, or
for $114 billion, I reckon you could pretty much pave the way between Melbourne and Devonport.
Well, you can put in the world's longest bridge, but you can certainly be a contender. And you probably put two bridges in actually for that amount of money. I mean, it's a staggering amount of money, and even building one corridor at a time, really, you're still looking at vast expenditure. So, look, hopefully this will be the end of high-speed rail, and we won't have to put up with people, rail nutters, talking about how wonderful it would be. As you can probably guess, Joel, I'm not the biggest fan of high-speed rail.
Finally, Bernard Keane, if I may, Margaret Thatcher and the sort of outpouring of Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, which has literally been climbing the charts, the music charts, since Margaret Thatcher died. What are your views on what the rules should be about how we behave after somebody famous has died?
I think we should be honest about what their legacy was. If they're a public figure, then there are different rules compared to private figures, and Margaret Thatcher obviously was a public figure. She was an enormously controversial and divisive public figure, and I think her achievements and the negative aspects of her time in public life should be recognised. I mean, this is a woman who did oversee the economic transformation of the UK that caused significant economic and social damage to some parts of the UK, was enormously beneficial to other parts of the UK, particularly the South East and London. So there's obviously going to be different reactions from different communities within the UK. And she was a Cold War warrior, and she was a woman who strongly supported fascist dictatorships in South America, for example, all as part of, the apartheid regime in South Africa, all as part of the broader sort of geopolitical agenda of the Cold War. And that should be recognised as well. So I think we do owe the dead the truth. And people are not... Margaret Thatcher has been demonised by some people since she died. She's been idolised by others. The truth's always somewhere in between, and I think that's what we should be aiming to get. Not putting people up on pedestals that the facts don't support, nor condemning them as demons or witches, in the way that she has been. People are more complicated, and political figures are always more complicated than their enemies or their most adoring supporters would like to have us believe.
It's been a pleasure, Bernard, and I don't have a pun to see you out on. Thanks for being on Statewide Mornings today.
No worries, Joel. Thanks.
Bernard Keane there, writer for crikey.com.au. Let's get some news headlines now with Peter Hughes.
Yes, hello again. The US President Barack Obama says the American people stand with Boston after two explosions on the route of the city's famous marathon. Two people were killed, more than 20 injured, although unconfirmed media reports in Boston say the injury toll has topped 100. Boston firefighter Steve McDonald was at the scene when the bombs exploded. He says it was fortunate that there was already a large presence of emergency services and medical teams there for the marathon. The Foreign Affairs Minister Bob Carr says the explosions in Boston appear to be a terrorist strike. He says the thoughts of Australians are with the United States government and the victims as they deal with the attack. Staff at the University of Tasmania are nervous about the future of their jobs. Meanwhile, the university has also confirmed future building projects could be in jeopardy if the funding cuts are implemented. A new research shows car dealerships in Australia had a record-breaking year of profitability in 2012. That's it. Our next at 11.
Thank you very much for that, Mr. Hughes. Let's go to Patricia Chu at RBS Morgan. Patricia, how are you doing? Oh, no, I haven't turned your button on. Try again. Hello, Patricia.
Hi.
How are you doing this morning?
I'm good.
Good, good. What's been happening in the markets today?
Good morning. Joel. Well, U.S. stocks suffered steep declines following the sell-off in Asian hours yesterday. The continued plunge in commodities unnerving investors. Oil is at their lowest level this year, while gold had its biggest drop in 30 years, down to a 14-month low. With that, Australia is opening up to another ugly day this morning. It is up from the lows of the day, but the ASX S&P 200, that's down 34 points. Big drops continue in the resource sectors. Our BHP, Rio, and Fortescue, they're down an average of about 2%. So BHP is down 31.70. That's down 60 cents. Rio is also down about 65 cents. Newcrest Mining, which is a gold stock, that's down another 8% at 1647. The big question really is what's happening with gold on a day like this with a bomb attack in Boston. One would expect gold to be up, but it has dropped another 21.40 cents this morning. We're trading $1,330 US dollars per troy ounce. Now, if you like conspiracy, Joel, you might like this.
Who doesn't like a conspiracy, Patricia?
Oh, yes, that's right. Well, on Friday, April the 12th, U.S. federal agents hit the market with 500 tons of naked shorts. That is, no physical metal was actually sold, just paper gold. At the then price of $15.50 per troy ounce, that trade amounted to $24.8 billion worth, a figure that only suggests that would suggest that only a central bank is behind the trade. Now, expectation is that gold might be hit twice more this week to drive it below the 1,400 per troy ounce level. Now, it is suggested that this is linked to Germany's recent request that the U.S. return their gold stored in the U.S. and the U.S. government's reply that it would return the gold piecemeal over 7 years. So the implication is that the U.S. doesn't have the gold at the moment, and this recent drought in the gold price may thus be just a manipulation.
Thank you very much for that, Patricia Chu. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Will do. Thanks, Joel.
Patricia Chu there from RBS Morgan.
Good morning.
Good morning.
If you're up and working, you're not the only one.
It's been quite a busy night, actually.
Well, I was soaking it in a bathtub.
And I said, oh. News headlines. This is a really good story. Probably Vegemite or Promite.
Which one are we going to eat?
Back to business.
Definitely.
Citrus growers up in arms.
That can't be good for
you. Come on, I don't want to leave you miserable.
This is a really good idea.
I think it's about getting a really good team of people around you.
It makes sense.
I need to get you a theme tune, I think.
Rick Goddard. Weekdays from 5:30 a.m. on 936 ABC Hobart.
You're with Joel Rheinberger. Listen online at abc.net.au/Hobart.
And Penny Terry is doing a statewide afternoons, the Your Afternoon program, after 2 o'clock today. Penny, how are you today?
I'm not too bad, Joel, and I think you in particular might be interested in the radio, the Savo. Are you a maths bloke?
I am a bit of a maths bloke.
I have to admit.
I'm generally the one who adds up the tally on the bill when it comes at the end of a group session at a restaurant.
Look, every good group of friends needs someone like you. It's either that or you need to travel with them overseas. So when you go from one country to another, you can work out the exchange rate.
Yes.
That's another reason why we need someone like you.
Is that pair of thongs, you know, $2 or $25? Very big difference.
Am I being ripped off? Today, we're going to Ravenswood Primary School to broadcast live. It's Maths Week up at Ravenswood Primary, and they've got a special mental maths village, and all of the students will be taking part. The parents are coming up as well. The teachers are involved. We're going to get a real idea about how to engage students when it comes to maths in 2013, because there are still a fair few problems to solve in Australia. There are less maths teachers. There are less students going on to pursue maths in secondary education. And there's also a really big gender disparity when it comes to the people that are pursuing a career based on mathematics. Heaps more blokes are interested in engineering and those types of careers than women. So we'll have a bit of a look at that, but I'm really keen to be taken back to the maths classroom, or it might have been the arithmetic classroom, and how differently it was taught when people that are listening this afternoon were at school. What do you remember about maths class, Joel?
The image that springs immediately to mind is a teacher who was a really good teacher, explained things really well, and a lovely man, but smoked like a chimney.
In the classroom?
Not in the classroom, but, you know, every moment he wasn't in the classroom, he was smoking like a chimney. He had yellow fingers, like three fingers on each hand were bright yellow. And this is in Dubbo, where it's 42 degrees all summer, and you'd ask him a question, and he'd come and hover over you while he explained it to you. And his explanations were lovely, but the stench coming off him was terrific. It was just enormous. Just, I understand now. You can stop telling me what's going on with the maths.
That's a pretty quick way to learn. But I'm sure people have many of those memories too. Maybe people have had the times tables on the back of the toilet door. It seems that if you go to any person's house who has got primary age children, that's there. It's important. We never had that at my house. I struggle a bit with the times tables.
It's the inchworm song. That's what you're after.
The what?
The inchworm song. Two and two is four. Four and four is eight. You don't know that one?
No, I have been.
Okay, I'm going to track it down for you, Penny, so you can play it during your program. It's a beautiful song.
Sounds good. So anyway, we're talking maths from Ravenswood Primary School today between 2 and 4.
Thanks, Penny. Bye.
See ya.
Penny Terry there on 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania on the Your Afternoons program from Ravenswood Primary this afternoon after 2 o'clock. Last few SMSs coming through from Hisham in Perth. After the September election, Gonski will be history. So will the current NBN structure. Why waste your breath talking about it? Dina Latrobe says, after the Gillard Abbott BS era, we won't be able to find the real Australia, even with the help of Google Earth. And Beth in Hobart says, Joel, O is the vowel in hot. Zero is the name of the mnemonic. It's confusing and wrong to use O when you mean zero, from Beth in Hobart. Beth, I challenge you on that. When have you been confused? I'd like you to actually tell me a time that you were personally confused by what I've said. And if you have been personally confused, I will apologise profusely. But if you haven't actually been personally confused, then you're just making a point that doesn't need to be made, in my personal humble opinion. Joining me now in the studio is Sally Bryant. Hello there, Sally.
Hello, Joel. I've got a slide rule in my little cupboard at home. That's how I learned maths.
Now, I've never used a slide rule. Did you actually find it useful?
No, fantastic. And I look at mine because it's in a drawer that I open frequently, and I think you can't throw that away. It's a terrific device. It's all manually operated.
And what did you actually use it for? It's for doing big,
adding,
complex...
Adding, subtracting. In fact, all multiplications, all cosines, arcsine, angles... Slide rules were invaluable. I don't know why they disappeared from the maths planet.
Because calculators...
became electric.
Yeah, it enabled you to do exactly the same thing. It's funny, I had one of my colleagues at the office talking about having to buy her son, who was going into year 11, a scientific calculator, and I had to say, and she's saying, look at them, you know, they're like $70 on this thing. I said, you've got to be kidding me. Does he have an iPod? You can get a scientific calculator app... for your phone now for like $2.
The world's changing.
Yeah, exactly.
Changed, full stop.
Now, what has been changing in the little world of your backyard?
Oh, fire, Joel. I noticed down my way, and I was one of the people involved, as soon as the fire permit period ceased, everybody, in fact, even a little bit before, everybody got out to clean up their backyard. Mm-hmm. And if you live in an urban/rural setting, it's what you do at this time of year. And myself included, how many frogs and skinks you're raking up. The rake is an evil instrument of conservation.
Death and torture.
And what you can do is you can build a little wildlife habitat clump in a part of your yard that isn't going to be in the wrong spot. And you can create a habitat clump so that when you do clean up around it to make yourself fire friendly and clean up, then you've got a safe haven to deposit the skinks and particularly the little frogs. And it can also be the understory section of your yard that you've now cleaned up and burnt. You can create that understory that can permanently remain in your backyard. So create a habitat clump, particularly for frogs. They need a refuge that's going to stay there long term.
You can give us a call, by the way, if you've got a question for Sally or a comment about some wildlife you've seen or you want to know about what that bird is that you saw. 1-300-222-936 is the number. We would love to hear from you. Now, frogs, what sort of frogs are you finding in your yard? Do you have a swamp at the end of your,
well,
end of your yard?
I do. That's exactly what I have at the base of my house. I've got a large dam. And at night and even late afternoon, the frogs are deafening. It is fantastic, and I'm very, very lucky to have lots of wet soaks on my property. So I've got three species of frog, including the little toadlet. I've got
the common froglet, is that one?
Yes, and the brown tree frog.
I took my boy to TMAG on the weekend, you know, to cruise around the animal exhibits and stuff, and he loves spotting the little frog on the table there.
And frogs, you know, you dig in the soil or you rake up a big pile of leaves that's sat there all season, and at the base are lots and lots of frogs. So you create a moist habitat, Joel, from a wildlife habitat clump, and you start off by demarcating the zone with big rocks and permanent bits of timber. And then you can lay newspaper or lots of fine leaves to create the wet base, and then fill it up with debris, rocks, soil, bark, sticks, into a big heap. And then even on the top you can create a mesh using branches to form a teepee on the top that little blue wrens can then get in amongst. And
so they can get in and eat the things that you've attracted.
Well, that too, but mainly nest come spring. They'll start to nest in that. So fill it up with bracken and bark and leaves. And just another little pointer in case I don't get back to this topic, because you can see I'm on a roll. If you're planting trees and restoring your habitat to using trees and you don't want too much litter on your ground, pick trees that don't shed bark, that aren't decorticating species, so that when they get large in windy weather or even as part of the natural process, they don't drop bark, because bark then is what you rake up and burn to clear your yard. So pick trees, species that don't drop bark.
So were there a lot of people raking up and then burning off in your area?
It was a little fire heaven down my way, which is in Lower Kingston, and everybody that's on a bush block was cleaning up and dutifully preparing for winter. And it is the right time of year to do it, and then you can bunker down over winter, and come spring and summer, everything will just blossom and emerge.
Now, if in a house in, say, suburban Hobart, which is not near a swamp, as your house is... That's always going to be in my head now. It's like, you know, I'm going to think of you as being like that witch from the Russian folk tales who has a house with chicken legs on it that can run around.
It's very similar. That's pretty true.
But, you know, if you're in suburban Hobart, in a drier sort of area, I've certainly see plenty of little skinks and stuff around my house and
but
spiders.
But you'd have fallen and leaves. So raking up the leaves and piling your leaves, even into a compost spot, into a part of the veggie garden in a back corner around your fence, you can pile up leaves that you rake and even grass clippings and just mix it with soil and rocks.
You're more or less making a sort of a composted area. But my question is, would I get frogs at my house?
Yes, you would, particularly if you're close to a bushy area where you have permanently damp soil. Frogs like wet. In fact, all amphibians need to be moist.
Moist,
they need
yep.
to keep their skin moist. And if you back into areas that are bushy, that are close to soaks or runoffs or drains, that's where your frogs will be located. If you're in a really, really dry spot, you might be a bit hard-pressed, but keep that lawn moist and, you know, keep a compost area going.
So I don't have compost at my house because I got a worm farm.
Ah, well, you know, you're creating habitat. And if frogs are not going to be your habitat thing, you can create habitat for bird species through your compost and through your worm farm, because so many small native birds, particularly robins, most of our honey eaters will come down and eat all the insects and invertebrates that are in your compost pile or your worm farm, or in that little part of your yard where you chuck stuff.
Oh, mine's one of those self-contained plasticky ones. And so I don't think that nothing can get to the worms and to the insects on mine.
Maybe you're wildlife unfriendly.
Yeah. I'm containing it all in plastic at the moment. A couple of SMSs have come through. Joel, the NASA engineers who worked out how to get Apollo 13 back to Earth did it with slide rules. How's that for useful? From Nigel the Chimney Sweep.
See, we've been to the moon and back.
Based on the old analog slide rules. And Barry in Rose Bay says, "Hi, Joel. I remember Sally at college, and she was one of the top math students. Surprised she didn't study physics rather than zoology." Is this true?
That's why I'm poor and not rich. Oh, Barry, I have to...
you're going to have to go and look back through the yearbooks and see who Barry was. See if you can find a picture of him in the classroom mooning over you from afar and your slide rule prowess.
Never, never.
What other ways are there to attract a little bit of wildlife to the yard? So, you know, again, say me, I've got a tiny yard on the back of my sort of little house, largely overshadowed by a massive walnut tree that's in the neighbour's yard. So my yard's in shadow half the time.
Well, mature trees and walnut trees, anything that produces fruit, nuts, buds, twigs, blossom, will attract our native birds. But, you know, not everyone can be wildlife friendly or has to be wildlife friendly. There's options, even if you live in apartments, to have tree boxes and shrubbery around your apartment block. But if you're not in that position or you're elderly, I guess one of the benefits of Tasmania, and particularly Hobart and Launceston, is you have access to beautiful natural wild places right on your doorstep. So if you're not wildlife designed for wildlife or want to attract wildlife, just go and enjoy it in our natural places. So every option is available to you.
If you've got a question for Sally Bryant, give us a call now on 1300 222 936.
If you're passionate about footy, you can't get through 2013 without a copy of ABC Football Magazine, edited by Grandstand AFL's Jared Waitley.
Steadies himself and pops it through!
It's your essential season guide, packed with player profiles, statistics and exclusive insights. Get all this and more in ABC Football Magazine, the must-have season guide for every footy fan. On sale now at newsagents, ABC shops and centres.
You're with Joel Reinberger on 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And you're also with Sally Bryant from Land Conservancy, talking about wildlife. Sexy Legs in Launceston says, saw a wedge-tailed eagle standing in a paddock near Deloraine Bass Highway last week. Magical.
You know, standing in a paddock, it had come down to feed on something that was dead in that paddock, or had dropped something in the paddock from nearby. And again, Joel, that's a little segue to say, please move roadkill, if it's safe to do so, off the road. Move it into the ditches, because we are entering into winter, and particularly carnivores and birds of prey and birds generally will come down onto the road, possums in particular, and investigate roadkill. Please move it off the road. And check those pouches for babies.
Ah, yes. Now, George from Kettering has called about your favourite subject, Sally. Hello, George.
Hello.
George, what is the favourite subject?
Padlocks.
Oh, gosh, I'm all ears, eyes, and I'm listening.
So
we
have a family of padlocks that have nested in our yard for about 3 or 4 years now. And we're wondering if it's the same ones keep coming back, mum and dad keep coming back to the same place, or if it's the offspring that come. How long do they last for?
George, let me ask you, when you say nesting in your yard, are they in a bank?
Yes, they're in a bank. Mm-hmm. Originally it was a dirt bank.
Mm-hmm.
We put a rockery around in front of the dirt bank.
Perfect.
And they've burrowed in through the rockery to get into the dirt bank in exactly the same place.
They were committed to that spot. That was their real estate.
That's
sounds
their
like spotted padlocks, George, which are so beautifully decorated, exquisite little birds.
Beautiful. Yes.
And yes, if you've been looking at that pair over several consecutive seasons, it is the same birds. They are quite a long-lived species, despite being tiny. They can live, we've got information on, believe it or not, 40 spotted padlocks, 12 plus years.
Wow.
From some banding work that was done in the 1990s. So, yes, they're quite a reasonably long-lived bird, and the offspring will be nearby, particularly if your habitat is suitable. So keep it up, George. Sounds like your backyard is very wildlife-friendly.
It's a source of enjoyment watching them teach the young ones to fly.
Are they easy enough to tell individual birds apart, or is he going to have to go out with a texter and put
you know,
an X on them?
It's not easy, and that's why leg banding has been the main source of identifying individuals, and that's with a metal band, which has a unique number on it, but also a colour band so that you can look through binoculars and pick up the colours. So it's not easy to tell males and females or even individuals unless they've got a very unique stripe or, for example, Tasmanian devils are quite unique and they all have a different blaze or a, you know, white chest marking. So, no, it's not easy. You have to just trust in fate.
Good on you, George. Thank you.
Thank you.
Peter's in Lower Longley. Hello there.
Oh, hi, Joel. Hi, Sally.
Hi, Pete.
I wanted to ask you about a small animal that I was observing in the bush and at Lower Longley, and we're about 400 metres above sea level, and it's dense bush area, and it was about a month ago, and it wasn't a bettong and it wasn't a bandicoot, and I've never seen a wombat up there, but it would have fitted in your small outstretched palm, pretty small animal, and it wasn't a hopping animal. Any clues?
Peter, you said it's not a bettong. You're not thinking potoroo?
Well, it wasn't a hopping animal.
Yeah, okay. Potoroos are generally smaller than bettong, but don't forget, young at foot or newly weaned and young are small in size. So potoroo are typically the small marsupial that likes wetter, denser bush, and I know Lower Longley quite well, so that's typical habitat around your way.
Yeah, okay.
Brown bandicoot are also a feature of wet sclerophyll bush, so it's not just eastern barred, but brown bandicoots, and of course you look for the pointy nose. Potoroos also have a pointy nose. They're the two sort of small weight range mammals that it could be. Do you think that's possible?
It could be. It just didn't look like anything I'd seen there before, but anyway, yeah.
You know what, Peter, just a thought. For landholders that want to know more about what's occupying your bush, you can get fantastic little cameras these days. Cameras have revolutionised how we do mammal surveys and wildlife surveys in general, and these little cameras for $200, and I know that sounds a lot of money, get onto the web, plug in Scout Guard or surveillance cameras. You can pick them up quite easily now, and you can set that little camera, you can leave it in the bush for weeks at a time, runs on batteries, and it will take photographs of everything you've got. Over a period of time, you can download it on your computer or look through it on the screen of the little camera. So why don't you invest or take up a collection, or if it's Christmas or a birthday or anniversary, put a little camera out
to have another look at about the same time, and didn't find anything, but
you can also look for scats.
I had my camera with me and hoping to be able to include a photo.
Well, these little cameras can stay in the bush. They're waterproof and they're quite well adapted. In fact, they're designed specifically for taking photographs of wildlife at night.
So are they movement activated?
They are. And so an animal will come up and it'll activate the shutter and you'll get a series of photographs. They're fantastic.
Terrific.
Put them on a runway, but you can also look for scats. And if you're really, really a super sleuth, you can put down a layer of sand and then come back and take some plaster casts of footprints.
Yeah. Terrific.
Good on you, Peter.
Thank you. Bye.
Frank's in Devonport. Hello, Frank.
Good morning.
Hi, Frank.
Hi, Sal. Look, before I ask my question, just an observation the other day, or the other weeks ago, I was in Launceston and at the car park, and I was highly amused to watch the sparrows sitting up on the ledge and waiting for cars to pull in. And as soon as that, not long after the people left the cars, the sparrows flew to the front of the car, and I wonder what they were doing. And they were picking off dead grasshoppers and everything out of the grill of the car.
Yeah, Frank, I knew you were going to say that. A lot of birds capitalise on that, particularly on mainland Australia, on the big highways. You know, they hang around service stations where cars pull in to get fuel. And not only is it a learned response, but it demonstrates how adaptive and smart birds can be.
Absolutely. 3 feet, wonderful.
Yeah,
it is. Now, tell you the question. I have two plovers on my front lawn, which I don't mind at all. They help keep the bugs and all down. But of course, every year, and I'm in town, and every year, of course, they lay eggs. And of course, as soon as the chicks are hatched, the local cats and dogs knock the chicks off. Is there any way I can sort of persuade them to go somewhere else?
You know, if anybody has an area they don't want plovers to nest in, put some debris down, Frank. Put some planks of wood, put some bricks, put a very temporary construction, because plovers love open spaces. So by filling the space in, park your car there, park something there, put some old furniture, even just to deter the plovers into another spot. That's a suggestion.
I think that'll go very well on the nature strip in front of my house.
I was going to say, this explains all those cars without wheels up on blocks.
Put your lawn clippings, put your debris, build something that is going to put a sign saying no plovers welcome here.
Okay.
Something to make it not an open space. But it isn't easy, Frank. And, you know, the best thing is to let a box drop. All of your neighbours that have got cats, saying keep your cats contained, because it's a well-known threat and cats are a major impact on all ground nesting birds.
I love to have them there. I enjoy it, but I think it's sad seeing the young chicks get...
Yeah, it is.
Okay, thank you, Sally.
Thanks, Frank. Lillian's in the Huon. Only got a couple of minutes left, Lillian. So,
yeah,
so...
No, I'm talking about pardalos, Sally. Our little... spotted pardalos used to nest in the bank, and they've been evicted by the striated pardalos. Is this something that happens a lot?
Oh, no, not often, Lily. In fact, striateds are usually nest in underhangs or cavities higher.
Yep, there's one nest in our roof cavity, but there's one that's taken over the little spotted.
Yeah, striateds are a little bit more... aggressive and dominating, but you know, if you put up heaps of soil, Lillian, even some, you know, get a little barrow load or even a little trailer load of sandy soil and put it in an area where you want to create some more spotted pardalo habitat.
We've got a huge bank, but the poor little pardalos, the spotted ones, tried to dig a little burrow and I don't know what happened, but I found their babies lying outside dead.
Yeah, evicted from the hole. It's yeah, it doesn't happen often, but it sounds like there's a bit of competition for your real estate. Mm. Just persevere and observe and see if those spotted pardalotes do just pick another spot nearby or may have moved on. But either species is fabulous to have
well,
in your area.
They're lovely things, but they're very bossy, and I did like the spotted ones.
Well, you know, when you're protecting your patch or looking for the best real estate, you don't want your neighbour to move in, so that's how birds operate.
Mm. Okay, Sally.
Good
you.
On you, Lillian.
Thanks, Lillian. Finally, Barb in South Hobart. We only have literally a minute left, Barb, so what would you like to tell us?
Okay. Good morning, Sally.
Hello, Barb.
I did have a long wandering story about the superb blue wrens, but can I just give you a quick question?
Give us the punchline, Barb.
I'll save it for another time because it's gorgeous, but can you tell me, do our dusky wood swallows migrate?
Yes, they do, Barb. They do migrate, and in fact, they'd be getting very close to migrating now,
and
as are all
the
birds.
Where do they spend the winter?
Well, they cross Bass Strait and they go up into southeastern Australia. I'm not sure. In fact, I'll do some homework, Barb, and tell you next time how far up they go, but they certainly do migrate.
We'll have to say farewell to you now, Barb, because we are unfortunately running out of time. Sally Bryant, it's been a pleasure as always.
See you soon, Joel.
See you soon, and I do want to see your chicken leg house in the swamp one day.
I'll show you a photo. You'll be impressed.
Sally Bryant there from Land Conservancy with Wildlife Talkback. She'll be back in a fortnight. If you have more questions, you can send them in the meantime to email tasmornings@your.abc.net.au, and we'd love to get photos so we can discuss those as well and whack them on the website. It's 11 o'clock, news time.